The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
I want to start it by introducing Wesley.
Yep.
So let's get
I'll set it up and then I'll hand it over to you.
Go ahead.
Cool. All right, everybody. This is the TechMeme Ride Home Experience for Tuesday, April 20th, 2021. Today was an auspicious day for the Apple event, the unveiling of a number of things, which we're going to talk about today. A reminder that this show is essentially the after show of the TechMeme Ride Home podcast, which Brian is the host of. And we like to talk about anything that's going on in the tech world, from a product design, market, computer history, internet history perspective, to try to put these things into context, to read the tea leaves, to understand what's going on and why, what pressures are on these things, and what might cause them to go in one direction or another into the future. And so with that, I will hand it off to Brian, who would like to introduce a new guest today.
Yes. So Wesley is... a member in good standing of the Mutant Podcast Army, a listener to the show for, I think, a long time. But I actually got introduced to him. We were on a Twit, Leah Laporte's show together. And Wesley, I believe, is based out of Austin. But Wesley, tell us anything you want to say about you or you know, promo anything. But like, I'd like you to be the co-host all night.
Thank you. Thank you for the stage. My name is Wesley Faulkner. I'm a developer advocate for a company called Daily at daily.co. They provide an API for video chat, also audio chats, similar to Twitter Spaces. If you're familiar with Agora, with Clubhouse, we do a similar service with video and audio.
And that's daily.co.
That's correct.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, Chris is a much better host than me.
You know, there's so many different ways to spell things these days. It's very important.
Wesley, thanks for joining us. And, you know, look, there's no, like, we're not formal table stuff here. let me set the table by saying this before we get into the details of what happened today. You know how I do the show is, like, you know, I have to scramble on days like today and like watch everything, write it up as soon as I can and get it out as soon as possible. You know, they hit, I swear to God, on the hour on the hour. So like they are getting so tight, Apple, doing these events, not live and in person, that this is my first throw it out there to anybody. I'm sure WWDC, they'll do another live event, but do you think they might eschew bringing the press into the Steve Jobs Theater? Like, they should just do this all the time because they're like, they've got it down to a science, I think.
Wow. It's a sort of like in a physical, I don't know, stage. And one of the things I guess that I would point out, and I did tweet about this today, was how much the visuals are, they seem designed for like screenshotting and live commentary. And you just can't really do that when you have an audience, you know, regardless of where they're set up, taking photos in an auditorium, you know, and trying to get visuals that are going to actually look good in this, you know, day of social media. So ultimately, I don't see a lot of upside in terms of either like the live experience or, you know, I mean, yes, there is some like hobnobbing, like rubbing shoulders kind of thing. But from what I heard, most of WWDC is going to be about having like live one-on-one sessions where you can meet other, you know, sort of developer advocates and people along those lines to learn. And it's more of an educational experience, less of a media event because they just don't need it in the same way that they once did. That's my thought.
Yeah. And I you're right. I forgot that WWDC is this year again, virtual. So I guess I take that entirely back, but, like, Wesley, do you feel like what I'm trying to suggest is that they're better this way. I'm not just saying that as like media people that cover it, but I feel like they're better at like getting across what they want to get across. So like, I'm wondering if like they're aware of that too.
I think it is good. They do value control. The part that I see as a negative is not necessarily on Apple's fault, on Apple's side, but on the press and the just media relations side. There's a lot of questions that come out of these keynotes and these that it's so much easier if you can just ask a lot of questions and even learn from the questions that are asked from the press around, but also developing those relationships, not only just with the PR people, but also with your peers. I think that is really something that helps with crafting a narrative and just makes the business of covering Apple better.
Well, and just the hands-on. I mean, I guess that's the answer, is they can't do away with it because they need, you know, Neil and folks to go into the next room and be like, well, here's my first impression of this, you know, which, Jesus Christ, I wish I could have been there for that today. But we'll get to that because the iMacs are, God, I want one. But before we get to the iMac, I want to start with the AirTags. So like before we build up to the big ticket items like the iMacs and the iPad Pros, can someone explain the AirTags thing to me from a business perspective? And maybe I'm asking you this, Chris. Like, is this, as I've been covering it, it's like, we've known about AirTags for years and it's never happened. And so it's been built up into this big thing. Is it a big thing? Like, is this a meaningful business to them? Like, if it was, why has no one else tried to do it? Like, it's not like Tile is the next Nest or anything like that. And Google and Amazon haven't jumped into this space. Like, do you see what the angle is for AirTags?
Yeah. This one is hard. Because on the one hand, I want to jump in and just like say yes. Like it makes sense. And there's a number of reasons why. I think one of the things that I noticed and, in watching the entire show was there was a very specific line, I think actually in reference to the iMacs, about how Apple's vision is really about having the computer just fade away and to basically not really be there. And I thought that's, it's very poignant, especially given that Apple Computer was the original name and then they dropped it a couple of years ago and now it's just Apple. And it seems like they're moving into both, they've been in moving the services business for a long time, but it's also about experiences. So the AirTags, in a way, kind of lock you into this ecosystem in a way that I can't fully anticipate. In other words, yes, you can, of course, put these tags on any kind of device and you can label it and so forth. But maybe it's that integration with the Find My app and the ability to see where your things are. And maybe that'll relate to, cars in the future, right? So if you think, I don't know when the car is coming out, if it's coming out in, 5 or 10 years or sometime less than that. But the ability to trust Apple with all of these intimate details requires that you slowly, boil the frog, so to speak, and get people comfortable with the idea of identifying things with these trackers. There are interesting aspects of that, whether you're using Find My Friends or, Find My Devices. I know personally my partner loses her phone constantly, and she's always using the Find My feature. And instantly when I sent her the photos of the AirTags, she was like, oh my God, like I need like 10 of those. So this is the thing that I think a lot of people experience. Actually, I'll have to share the tweet, but there's a great Magic Mushrooms reference in the little segment that actually is promoting the AirTags, and it's not really so much about the Magic Mushrooms as it is about the relationship that people have to their computing devices, which are now becoming legion, and they need to have access to. And if you lose something, pulling out your phone, finding it quickly. I don't know if AirTags and Find My is going to be something that is on Android. I don't know if it's on Android now, but that is another way of kind of creating this privacy mode where you're trusting Apple and the Apple Cloud to have access to all this personal information about where things are, and no one else will have that information. So that to me also feels like it's a part of this story.
Wesley, do you buy that's essentially it's an ecosystem and lock in play. Like, is it? I just don't feel like there's enough here. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think it's a lock in play per se, but I think it's akin to when the Apple Watch launched and they kind of geared it towards what they thought people would like, and then when they came out with the second gen, they said, "Oh, fitness is where it's at." This is the MVP. This is the minimum viable product for the U1 chip. They want to put this out there to see what people will do with it and what will really catch on. Yes, you can find your keys. Yes, you can find maybe your iPhone. But I bet they'll maybe use this for see if this is like a personal tracker for pets maybe or for other items around maybe – work will use it as an internal office locator to figure out where people are or how close people are together if there's still issues with, you know, COVID in a few months from now. So I just think that they're just going to put it out there. This is the MVP to kind of let people hack around and use the general audience as a public focus group to how they're going to evolve this in the future.
You know, what are, so to build on that, I think to some degree, it feels like, and Brian Romelli actually commented on this in all the way back in September 2019, but was talking about the U1 chip in these products and getting those out into the world. And again, the other lens that I tend to evaluate Apple's practices through is around the degree to which it allows them to sell more silicon, right? Apple silicon specifically, but they need more applications to move more product. You know, if the iPhone starts to, you know, trail off in terms of its growth potential, then there have to be many, many more devices and products that require that part of the supply chain to keep running in order for their business to keep minting as many millions as it has been. And so in this case, the U1 chip and the ultra wideband connectivity that is in it allows you to create a field of computing that allows all sorts of different things, I think, to start occurring, many of which we probably can't even imagine yet. But it does seem as though, again, Apple is trying to remove the centrality of the, you know, computer as the place where all computing happens and to put it into the world around you. So there's more ubiquity and universality. So I think that's part of this.
Well, and there's a piece already up today from Forbes that says that this is Apple's next billion-dollar business, which, you know, at Apple scale, that's not hard to do. But the point of the piece was that all Apple has to do to make AirTags based on what they're selling them at a billion-dollar business would be to sell 35 million of them this year. And there are over a billion devices that already have the Find My app on them. So it's entirely conceivable that they could sell 35 million AirTags in the first year. I don't know. I see what you're saying, that there's this is sort of laying the groundwork level, which also we might talk about, especially with the Mac stuff coming up. Before we get to the Mac stuff, can I just put in a thing again, Chris, as product guru? How do you feel about the Apple remote theoretically being less shitty than it was all of a sudden?
I mean, it does – well, sure. It seemed like it wasn't a very high mountain to climb there. I like the move of the Siri button off to the side. I like the hardware physical buttons. It just seemed like that was an obvious thing that needed to happen. And it was, you know, I think TV is going to be one of their major core experiences, especially, you know, with the retirement of the large HomePod. And so getting that entertainment center and experience right is very important. And also being able to use, and I have high doubts about the Apple remote in use for games, but it seems like using it for games is something that they want to at least have people contemplate, because gaming is going to be a major place where I think they're going to drive a lot of Apple subscriptions. And so having that device just available for people to use, I think seems a piece of that. In other words, sticking with what they had before, the sort of, I don't know, like tongue depressor design, just wasn't helping anything move forward in that front.
Agreed. And I, as I pointed out on the show, I was very disappointed by the fact that this would have been the opportunity to say that Find My is integrated into the remote And
I saw that. Someone else mentioned that, and I was like, oh, Brian talked about this on the show today.
Yeah, that's insane to me because
it does. It seems so obvious and such a mess. And it's like one of those great examples where like one part of the company is not talking to the other part, and they just like – it was like a fail in my sense, especially since like the demo that they used was like losing your keys in the couch.
Right, right. I'm one of those guys that's like, you know, am I leaving the house? I check all of my pockets with my hands. I've got everything in there. There's no way I could leave my house without my keys in my pocket. However, you know, the kids lose the remotes.
Constantly.
Yeah, constantly.
I mean, not to mention like the AirPods, right? I mean, yes. I won't even get into that, but. Do you want to bring some folks up?
Yeah, bring some folks up before we get into the Macs. Like, if anybody has any comments at this point, and even you can lead us into the Macs, but anyone that has questions, raise your hand and let's bring you up.
Before we move on, I just wanted to jump in about the AirTags one more time. Is just not to just focus on the consumer facing usage for it, because think about it, if you went to a store, you get a coupon code, and your U1 chip tells you what shelf the item is, or if you need help.
And so from a basically perspective,
internal GPS. And now you can sell thousands of them to retail stores.
Yeah.
Let's not be limited to the consumer facing application right now.
Yeah, the AirTag is really interesting because it was like, 2 years ago that it was rumored?
Okay, this is Steve.
Oh, sorry, just to give a quick intro. This is Steve from Growth Hack Rumors.
Cool. Go for it.
Yeah. I don't know whose theory this was, but the idea that, you know, it was rumored, Guy Rambo at 9to5 Mac leaked it first, and then all this antitrust stuff started to flare up, and Apple's worried about Tile, and I guess they're going to go talk to a House or Senate hearing tomorrow, and Tile's going to be in attendance, so that should be finally been released. So Apple could have pivoted to focus on the Find My network. But like, why does it make sense for them? Yeah, I still feel like there's something left out there that Apple hasn't announced yet. And I think there's some patent around some AR piece of it, but it is interesting that there is an AR aspect to this, because when you're finding it actually uses ARKit, it's not really clear to me how it uses ARKit to find your device when it doesn't seem like it's a visual thing, but poking around the code and stuff, it looks like there's some hints around, like it might ask you to turn on your flashlight or something if you're in a dark environment.
Right. Well, I described it, I used the term on the show today, like Marco Polo-esque, where it's like the video that they showed today, it was like, well, you're 2 feet away, turn left or whatever. But they specifically said that your phone would be using the LiDAR and the cameras and things like that to lead you to the thing as well. It's not just that it's like going to be pinging a noise underneath the cushion. It's also going to like lead you in that direction.
Right. Yeah. I'm just wondering, like, can it like lead you around? Like, it knows like a wall's there. So it says like, oh yeah, you need to go forward and then turn kind of thing or something. But yeah, as far as the larger picture, it seems like it's got to be something related to like AR and Apple's focus there. And if we'll see something more, I think there's some patent about like using these, some sort of tags for placing stuff in an AR VR space. So there's got to seem like there's this more hidden functionality here. But yeah, I'm really curious if these third party trackers that have the U1 chip in it, will it be the same effect, or is there extra special secret sauce in the Apple AirTags versus the third party ones? It's yet to be seen.
Hey, Steve, please stay on stage because we'll have lots of questions to ask you for input as well. But Nathan, real quick, jump in before we get to the Mac stuff.
Yeah, I think we just didn't touch on the privacy aspect, which is, you know, sort of like screen time. Mm-hmm. Right after screen time was released, you then saw other apps that were trying to do screen time-esque behaviors start complaining because they got restricted.
Interesting.
You know, I backed the original Tile Kickstarter, and I knew that I was like, okay, I'm, you know, trusting this company with this information, and if they ever get hacked, you know, there's some issues that, you know, I would have to worry about there. But I think Apple, knowing that they have the mesh network of all devices, not just the ones with the Tile app installed, plus the privacy, it's a good enough reason to do it just because they can deliver a better experience than any, like, person who doesn't own the operating system.
Yeah, I think one thing that's really interesting, and I don't understand this about the Tile product and the Tile. I was just looking, trying to see their privacy policy. You know, whether or not Tile actually uses that information about where beacons are to track you and to, you know, create profiles about you, right? And one of the things that was specified, and I think this is actually kind of interesting, and Brian, you might have some thoughts about this too, is the way in which the AirTags will recycle identifiers. And obviously this is a big deal when it comes to whether, like, it's, you know, app tracking transparency, or when it came to oh my God, I can't think of the name. What was the Google Apple COVID tracking API?
The name of it, I don't know, but it was right. the Google Apple tracking.
See, it was a really big deal for for 5 minutes.
Exposure notification.
Yeah, exposure notification. Thank you. So that process of identifying a device and sort of, you know, holding onto the identifier for some period of time and then recycling it and then kind of like losing all recollection or memory of where it's been, obviously is a very important feature, privacy preserving feature. And that is one of the things that they did tout in the AirTag, demo and conversation today. So if that contrasts, and Nathan, I think you're bringing up a very good point, with Tile's approach, then one, that sort of blows up Tile's business. And second, does or may, as you suggest, you know, expose the underbelly of these kind of data aggregators, which Apple has been on a tear against, and that there's now laws in California that are fighting back against. And suddenly those businesses will be also disrupted, which, you know, is going to eventually get to this passion creator economy thing probably later on in the show. But nonetheless, I think that's a very astute point.
Yeah. And, you know, to be clear, Tile claims they don't sell any information whatsoever. But I'm more concerned about the sort of things like the Strava leak where, you know, people's run routes were exposed, through not, you know, Strava's intentional like selling of my information, but, you know, through just the mishandling of my personal data.
Right. And I don't want to speak out of turn. I don't know anything about Tile's, you know, data practices. So I'm not speaking as though that's what they're doing. I'm just saying if that is what they're doing, then this would be definitely a shot across the bow of that practice.
Yeah, certainly only Apple setup where only Apple can turn on all iPhones for, you know, everyone that has
right. Right, exactly. And well, I also brought up, you go by Sui or David, or do you prefer David?
Yeah, David is fine. Hi, okay. Hi. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yep, you're good.
So just to one comment and one question. Maybe I'll start with the question first. For those 1 billion devices to connect, do they all need to have the U1 chip or no?
Go ahead. I'm sorry, say that again?
They only need Bluetooth to...
Right. Wow. Okay.
Yeah, that's what I thought. That's where that number comes from. So any of the iDevices that have Bluetooth on basically become part of that mesh, and they can essentially report any devices that they see that I guess happen to be emitting an ultra wideband signal or something that is probably compatible with Bluetooth low energy.
So the question would then be, when there are more U1 devices, what does that mean to this mesh network?
Yeah, that I don't know. I don't know enough about the U1 chip.
That's beyond my ken entirely.
Seems like all a right, good cool direction guys. For us to like look into.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't think there's any network effects with the U1 chip. I think it is, for now, at least, just the finding aspect.
Yeah, I think right now it's mostly like an emitter, right? Which is probably similar to the Tile. And I don't know, again, I don't want to speak out of turn. It seems like these chips are really, you know, they're Bluetooth low energy and they're just kind of emitting, a signal. And, you know, you're getting some... I don't know. And then that information is relayed to the Apple Cloud. And then if you're looking for a specific unique identifier from one of those U1 chips, then you'll be able to locate it within a certain range over a certain period of time, you know, based on battery limitations, et cetera.
Yeah, it's finer grain than Bluetooth, so it can know kind of exactly, you know, within centimeters of where you're at, also like higher bandwidth. One difference too with the car key aspect is if you have the NFC version of that, you have to place it in a specific spot in your car to unlock your car.
Right. Yep. Very similar to the Tesla key.
Does it anywhere in your car?
Mm-hmm. The issue with the U1 chip is that it has beam forming, which means it can tell the direction of things, and that's why it's able to burst at the higher data rates, because it can actually do the beam forming for the antenna. So that's how it can tell direction. And so that's what makes it different from Bluetooth.
Cool.
Yeah, you know, I used to work in the Apple stores, and remember those beacons when iOS used to support beacons? Yeah, and we were trying to use it for multiple different purposes, right? Security, device authentication, but also updates and pinpointing problems. And but there's also one use case that were experimented was file transfer, data transfer among devices within the mesh network. So, you know, I just imagine AirDrop via the U1 trip, you know, from Hong Kong to San Francisco. Anyway, I'm done here.
What was the other one that I was thinking about? You said AirDrop. Oh, the app clips. I don't know if this has any relevance to that, but the idea where you just sort of go around in the world and kind of, you know, get slices of apps or experiences or do checkout or payments, all of those things seem to be enabled by, again, just what I see is this growing mesh of Apple interconnected devices.
Let me cut it off just because we're edging too much here. Can we get to the IMAX and then the iPad? Listen, I'm using sexual language because I don't give a shit about cars. Even sometimes phones leave me cold, but man, nothing turns me on more than a sleek computer and mostly laptops, but Jesus Christ, man. What they did with this iMac is—it's just blown my mind. And I've been, you know, spending half the evening looking around, and like I found the specs or like a side picture that claims that like the entire computer is in the chin. So like I described it as, and again, I hope people have heard. Some of you might have heard the show today, but whatever. I described it as essentially an iPad maxi, like the most blown up iPad you could imagine on a sort of swivel arm. And then if you do like a side cutout of it, all of the computer is in the chin. That's why they still have the chin.
Yeah.
And so it's just a glorified iPad where they just put, more sort of a muscle down there in the bottom. God damn. I don't even need an iMac right now. I'm still happy. And by the way, I need more ports. I need an SD card reader. So I'm not gonna run out and get this. But listen, I'm opening up the floor to other people that either were disappointed or are like me. Like, goddamn, I love this thing.
I think it's awesome. I think it's what's really interesting is this is the first Mac that Apple's released where they've redesigned the computer around M1.
Yeah.
And thing like what you said, like putting out all the guts in the chin, is just really fascinating. I really like it. I just can't wait to see the M1X 27-inch replacement as well. I'm curious if we're going to see like a black bezel, kind of more black professional look. I was kind of off a little bit by the bezel and everything. I don't know. And the no Apple logo is really odd, but I like it. Like I don't like how Apple brought back the MacBook Pro word marker or whatever on the bottom of the MacBook Pro screen. They removed it for a bit and then they added it back. I'm like, yeah, no logos, no text on the front of my machine, please. I think it's great.
I think that the power and data connection is an interesting mix where you can now explore possibly having multiple ports or a hub that just ties into the power. I think that's super curious. And also the Touch ID, how are they making that work? Because if you use this keyboard with Touch ID on another older Intel-based Mac, Touch ID doesn't work. It just works as a Bluetooth keyboard. So there's something special there in terms of the data transfer. Share.
They actually talked about it. Yeah, so it's encrypted. So basically the thing that's really interesting about this, and by the way, for those of you, actually everyone's here on Twitter Spaces, you can go in and just look at the top of the space, and I'm pinning tweets that are related to what we're talking about. So I just posted a photo of the guts of the iMac Pro. So Brian, you can actually go and see this thing and what it looks like as in an X-ray view. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the Touch ID, which I think is actually super important, super interesting, there's two features of this that are really great. So one is that, yes, it's just like it's like the secure enclave chip that they use on other devices. So they're still using the same architecture. And the idea is that there's some part of the computer that basically does that verification, that holds the identification information, and then probably, and I don't know, you know, how this works or not, but probably passes like a go, no-go authentication, I guess signal or something that says, okay, you can log in as this person. The other thing that it does, from what I could tell, at least from the video, was when you use your fingerprint. It actually identifies you as a user and will do fast user switching, which is new. Now, from what I recall, and you guys can tell me if I'm wrong because I don't actually share an iPad with anybody, but there's still sort of iPads are single user devices, right? Still true? Just now?
Except in a business or education setting. So yeah, for most consumers, it's a single user.
But there's no like Apple account in the sense that all of your app settings, preferences, like on a Mac, right? You can swap between different user accounts.
Right.
Okay. So I don't know when or if that might happen, but you can imagine that if that is happening on the, iMacs here, then that type of behaviors, well, I don't know. I guess like maybe that the iPad will still maybe remain forever like a personal device that for there will only ever be one user, whereas the iMac is a shared family computer. And so therefore the fast user switching tied to the Touch ID sensor, I think to me sounds like a super amazing, convenience, innovation, and maybe that will happen more in other places too, but we haven't, seen that kind of thing in the Apple TV. Although I do think that you can now swap your preferences around. Anyways, yeah, so the Touch ID thing is
Steve. When you go through airport security, there's one line where the TSA agent checks your ID and another line where a machine scans your bag. The same thing happens in enterprise security, but instead of passengers and luggage, it's end users and their devices. These days, most companies are pretty good at the first part of the equation where they check user identity. But user devices can roll right through authentication without getting inspected at all. In fact, 47% of companies allow unmanaged, untrusted devices to access their data. That means an employee can log in from a laptop that has its firewall turned off and hasn't been updated in 6 months, or worse, that laptop might belong to a bad actor using employee credentials. Collide finally solves the device trust problem. Collide ensures that no device can log into your Okta-protected apps unless it passes your security checks. Plus, you can use Collide on devices without MDM, like your Linux fleet, contractor devices, and every BYOD phone and laptop in your company. Visit collide.com/ride to watch a demo and see how it all works. That's KOLIDE.com/ride, collide.com/ride. How do you make a password that's strong enough so no one will guess it, and it's impossible for you to forget, and do it for 100 different sites, and make it so everyone in your company can do the same without ever needing to reset them? Sounds impossible unless you have 1Password. More than any other product I've ever told you about, I can vouch 1,000% for 1Password. I can't live without it. 1Password makes strong security easy for your people and gives you the visibility you need to take action when you need to. Any device, anytime, 1Password lets you securely switch between iPhone, Android, Mac, and PC with convenient features like autofill for quick sign-ins. All you have to remember is the one strong account password that protects everything else. Your logins, your credit cards, secure notes, or the office Wi-Fi password. 1Password's award-winning password manager is trusted by millions of users and over 100,000 businesses from IBM to Slack. It beat out 40 other options to become Wirecutter's top pick for password managers. Right now, my listeners get a free 2-week trial at 1Password.com/ride for your growing business. That's 2 free weeks at 1Password.com/ride. Don't let security slow your business down. Go to 1Password.com/ride. Steve, can I ask you real quick, were you surprised that we did get iMacs today, the bringing M1 chips into at least some iMacs today?
I was going to be surprised, except then Gurman said, hey, what do you guys think about like an M1 and an iMac? Okay, yeah, there is a good chance that it's around the corner then, because, yeah, I didn't really see too much like in the code pointing towards like iMac anytime soon. But yeah, then they dropped it. But yeah, as far as like multi-user stuff, I don't see that coming to iPad. I think it's just like a back from the Unix underpinnings. But then again, I thought we'd never see Touch ID in a wireless keyboard. So, there's that. I was poking around the code and looked like there was something about some new like, cloud pairing or something with Bluetooth devices that isn't related to like the AirPods. It might be called like Firefly or something. So it seems like a lot of work around there to figure out how to make this work. And then one other piece of that is like if you try to use Apple Pay on one of these new iMacs with the keyboard without the Touch ID, it's going to tell you, like, hey, you need to hook up a Touch ID keyboard to use Apple Pay.
Wait, are you saying it will tell you that?
Yeah, yeah. There's a string in there that explicitly calls it out of, like, hey, you tried to use Apple Pay, but you're not connecting to your Touch ID keyboard. So make sure.
So, but there must be some other way, some fallback, like where you can, like, authenticate with your phone, maybe?
Yeah, maybe. Like, I don't know. Like,
huh?
Yeah, I don't know how that works, but that was just interesting. And I think Apple kind of on background was talking to some bloggers about, you can use this keyboard with older devices, but right.
Yeah, so it has that
in one Max.
That's the question that I had, is that just to clarify that I understand it's a Bluetooth keyboard, but that transfer with the Touch ID probably is not Bluetooth. So there's some other wireless standard that it's using on these M1 Max and iMacs that allows Touch ID to work. So there's some radio other than Bluetooth that's handling the communication between the keyboard and the system.
Why do you say that? Why would Bluetooth not be sufficient for that?
Bluetooth is so insecure. It wasn't really built on super security, not to the point for Touch ID that I don't believe that they would use on top of Bluetooth to do that type of transfer.
Even if the payload is encrypted?
Yes, but we're talking about the... If the decryption is on the Mac itself, not on the keyboard, in terms of how it's sending it over, that's even if it's encrypted hash, I would not have that over the air in something I didn't control. So yeah, there has to be something part of the stack.
Yeah, and it'd be something like AirDrop, Wi-Fi Direct, or something. Mm. But I figured like the FCC would have, you know, we'd have some details. But that's something good to look for. I'll definitely make a lookout for that. Of like, is there any new FCC details on these keyboards or something?
Yeah, that's interesting. David, I brought up, I don't know if you had a comment or a question.
Okay, so I kind of wanted to zoom out in a way that I feel like might derail this conversation. So please let me know if I'm derailing instead of maybe providing.
We'll
let you know. Okay. Thank you. The thinness thing regarding products that are almost certainly destined to basically remain static for 100% of their lifetimes, right? The iMac. And these engineering gymnastics that I'm sure the hardware team undergoes, the R&D money. Basically, the thinness thing. I remember I was watching it when the MacBook Air original was pulled out of the manila folder. It's cool, right. But it's long past time that we chill, in my opinion. I guess what I'm asking is, are we, like, at what point do we stop making tremendous hardware sacrifices in the name of miniaturization? Generally, but especially for desktop PCs.
This is right up my alley because.
I know.
I've been saying that about the phones and things like that for a long time. But let me, because this is actually something that I wanted to bring up. And look, everyone knows this. Like, look at what they're doing. This is an iMac that looks like an iPad. The iPad Pros. Look the same, stay the same. Your iPhone, the most recent iPhone, has the exact same design aesthetic as an iPad in a sense. Like, so we know they're doing it in front of us. They're not making any secret about it. Like, they're going to release sometime in the next 5 years a combination of a MacBook and an iPad, and I don't know what they'll call it or what way they'll do it, but like, you know, I'm looking at this iMac and I'm thinking like
a MacPad,
right? A MacPad, but like think about like look at that hinge where it's like what's the huge Microsoft Surface thing where you pull it down and you draw on it and things like that. You can see this coming. You can see that you could even maybe pull that out if it's light enough. We are literally a couple years away from this completely being unified. And what was it that I quoted from today? It was like Dieter or Nilay was saying that, like, yeah, look, I mean, it's all the same architecture now. They're all using the same M1 chips. So, like, this is so coming, and the design language is pointing in this direction. So I get what you're saying, except for the fact that, like, I see what they're doing, and I love it.
I think you guys are talking like a little bit past each other, though, because if I understand, I don't. So, David, the challenge or the issue that I have with your point, I guess, is what is it that you would like the computer to be able to do, regardless of form factor, right? Ultimately, this is a screen, and it's got a bunch of pixels on it. And every year, you get some more colors, and they move faster across the screen, and, you know, the computer can, like, calculate more things, like, simultaneously. Like, that's kind of like the jam. And Apple, meanwhile, and, you know, this is what I wrote about in, like, 2016, is you know, building and making sand that is sold as jewelry. So the markups are amazing. It's like De Beers, except a little bit more interactive. And so when it comes to this question, I guess, that you're putting to us, which is, you know, couldn't Apple make a really fat, lazy computer that just, like, you know, is super, super honking and, like, does all these amazing things and all the nits and the GPUs and all the rest and this, and, like, that's their $16,000 product, because that's sold to the high end, which is doing, you know, video animation or, you know, movie animation and stuff like that. For their, I think, core audience, which I guess my thought is they're probably not too much like you or I anymore, you know, are people who want less computers in their life. They don't want to feel like they're around computers. Like, the whole color aspect of this is that this is a device that you, like, live with, you know, more or less like the HomePod. I was actually thinking about this again, like, with the AirTags in particular, and in a bunch of these other products, Apple is refuting the idea of what a computer is and should look like. Like, literally, they partnered up with Hermé to elevate the idea of, you know, what Tile has is sort of like this disposable thing that you could, like, you know, lose, and, like, it's not a big deal, and it's kind of around, and, you know, attracts your stuff or whatever. But they're saying that, no, this is a piece of jewelry that you attach to your very fine, your finest items. And when you want to find them, you will use your iPhone to get at it. And that's where they can charge their premium. So with all that said, I guess, what is it that you really want the computer to be able to do that it can't do, that the form factor sort of prevents it from doing?
It's not necessarily about features or capabilities. It's about checks and balances. And I guess, instead of answering with specific features, I would rather Apple spend their energy and their resources on a different direction.
Okay.
And maybe just pause here.
Yeah.
Like, with the, like, my 12 Pro Max, I can't imagine it being any thinner and still being usable.
Usable for what purposes?
Well, just me, like, as a phone. I just feel like the thinness thing has pretty much run its course. And it, like, the place to start bringing this up and taking your time would be on specifically in the desktop segment. But, like, I understand, and actually it's insightful, because what I just realized is the iMac being sort of, they're differentiating with the word pro between... I don't know. They really haven't bifurcated too much between the pro and the non-pro lines across the range, I guess. Mm. But I guess the implication is that the iMac is for everybody, and that everybody that you're talking about are the people who want computers to be less visible in their lives.
Yeah, I mean, I think you really have to look at, and I think this is really important, and it's a subtle way to gain insight. But everything in these events is intentional. Everything that they put together, and especially now that they're not having to, you know, put this in front of the press, right, where the press is the audience, the press is the filter that explains to the end users what is important and what is interesting. Apple now can do that directly. So if you look at the clips of people using these products, that will tell you the story. And a couple of years ago, if you actually need to find it, I'll post it as a pinned tweet to this space. But I wrote about how Silicon Valley was all wrong about the Amazon Echo Show. And my point was that the imagery and the people and the scripting that they used to talk about this new product, which was more or less just a video intercom, right, that had a voice assistant attached to it, which, of course, is very important to Amazon's long-term strategies, was super pedestrian. It was not dolled up at all. These were not pieces of jewelry that are connected to the internet that you want to spend a premium on. The idea was that you'll buy a bunch of them, you know, just like you'll buy a bunch of the Echo Puck devices or whatever, and put them all over the place, because that was the field of computing that Amazon wanted to offer people, and they wanted to do it at a price point that was super accessible. And so if you look at the way in which people are presenting the iMac, it is a statement piece, just like the HomePod was intended to be. When people come over, they see it and they're like, oh, well, aren't you fancy, Mr. Brian, Mr. Fancy Pants? You've got a new colored iMac. Well, that's brand new. I love seeing that. And so I think it's and I guess what I'm just trying to offer is a way to interpret the Apple event like film, and to look at the scenes that they show and the way that people are interacting with those computing products. And when they show families who are interacting with these devices, and the degree to which they, you know, kind of care about, like, I don't know, like going deep into the guts and understanding it, it's, no, Apple's going to take care of this for you. You are the subject, and Apple keeps you safe. And I know that that's very, like, sort of anathema for those of us who sort of have been in the computer freedom movement for a long time, but it just feels like that's the message that I take away from that. So, Brian?
Yeah, so, again, I feel like today I was totally prepared to be underwhelmed by today, and I was more whelmed than I thought I would be. Chris, you know, listeners to the show know, like, I've been talking about like the Facebook portal and like why, you know, what did we do? It was a story last week about how, you know, Facebook is maybe doing something that's portal like, or like the Amazon show or whatever. And I was like, of course they're doing that. No, again, it's right here. Look at what this is. Now, this is a higher end thing. This is still a computing device, but this form factor, where 5 years from now, this is a cute, colorful thing that you've got one in your kitchen, you put one in your kid's room, they're already putting the camera in there like the portal that moves around as you're walking around the room. This is, and then, so imagine that this is also something that you can pick up and remove from the device and walk around as a tablet. This is going back 25 years. This is the sort of
the information navigator.
No, it's what do they call it? A computing. What do you call like a refrigerator? Like a
an appliance.
Appliance. A computing appliance. So like these are cute things that will be able to do all of these things for you, and they're gonna want. Like already iPads are sort of like the entry level into the deeper computing level of the Apple ecosystem. Like, they really want you to get an iPhone, but if you don't, like, you know, spend a couple $400 and get in with an iPad, the cheapest iPad you got. Well, they can combine these things, and these are going to be the things that they're going to want to put 4 or 5 of them in your house in various rooms. Like, I see that now. This is so clear to me. You know, there will always still be a bigger iMac and things like that, but like I'm seeing the form factor that is going to be the next decade of this angle of Apple computing.
Yeah, it was interesting. Like, this was Apple's chance to like have, like I talked about before, a new design around the M1 and that architecture. I was like, okay, if we're going to see a touchscreen iMac, it's going to be now. And we didn't get that. So it must be, okay, we're not going to get that. I don't know about a MacBook. I'd still love to see that. But as far as like, you know, a larger computer, I think that's like the rumored, much talked about X-Mac that Apple's never going to make, which is the consumer Mac with replaceable cards. But I don't think Apple wants consumers messing with cards at all. I think it's just going to be, you know, plug and play with the Thunderbolt ports. Although I guess we didn't see any eGPU stuff today. I think that's still to be seen if Apple's going to allow users to use third-party graphics cards with the Apple Silicon architecture. So we'll see what's there. I love the magnetic connector. It's like, don't call it MagSafe connector. But I love it. Just the little details. It's got the color match cord and the color match lighting cable, which unfortunately we still have to flip over.
On beta. Okay, cool. Slowly the room's coming back together. I sent the link to Brian. He should be here soon. Wesley up here. There's Brian. Cool. And crash it again. Okay, Brian's back up. Cool. I was, you know what it was? I was trying to bring up my post about Silicon Valley and the Echo Show. And man, Twitter did not like that link. It's not very happy with me. So, but I'll send it to you guys and you can see it.
Someone,
while we're coming up here, I have a couple things I wanted to tack on to the size debate on the iMac.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
I have two things. First of all, the form factor, why it's so thin. It's so thin because it's a differentiator between Intel and AMD. They can't make form factors that look like that. And they don't have a long, super long lead time. I mean, those are going to be in development, at least from the AMD side. I'm not sure how far behind Intel is, but they will not have an exclusive on that form factor for too much longer. So it's better to get out there now and seen as the leader while they still can. So it's very important for them to do that from that perspective.
So you're saying we're gonna see everybody doing this, which happened after the Air and everything like that. Like, this is gonna be the new hotness pretty quick.
Right. And the second thing that they mentioned several times, but it's not really a headlining issue, is their 2030 initiative. When you use less materials, you can pack more of those devices in a shipping container. It's going to be lighter, so it's going to be cheaper logistically to get them around. And they're using recycled aluminum, which means the raw material now is something that is precious when you're recycling that and making more devices. And so the size is actually an advantage from them from a cost standpoint. They use less raw materials. And because of the lightness, it's cheaper for them logistically to ship it and to get it in the hands of consumers.
Yeah, I think just to add to that, I mean, one of the ways in which the event started, from what I recall, was Tim Cook coming out and basically talking about, you know, their plans to be carbon neutral and to be a, you know, environmentally sustainable company, which you see a bunch of companies moving towards. But the fact that this is all aluminum, the fact that they're using a bunch of recycled material in the product itself, the fact that these are lay flat devices and they're no longer these curved weird shapes with all the styrofoam that goes in the packaging itself is using, and I feel like I'm just like, you know, rattling off their talking points, but like using virgin trees from like well-managed forests or something like that. I don't know, but like, I think that is very important in terms of managing this enormous supply chain and the logistics, which obviously is, you know, Tim Cook's, you know, sort of bread and butter. And the more they can reduce the complexity and the different types of parts and components, the more streamlined and the more cost efficient this can be. So
that's something that's underappreciated in certain circles, where everyone thinks that, oh, of course, this is virtue signaling for, like, we're, you know, going carbon neutral and we're doing recycle. No, there's efficiencies. Like, what people don't
know,
capitalism is making things cheaper, making things more efficient, and to a certain degree,
and then charging the same rate for years.
And to a certain degree, that is exactly what happens when you see a Tim Cook stand up and say, like, you know, this is the packaging has been reduced by 80% or whatever, you know, and exactly what you're saying is like, it is more efficient and that goes directly to their bottom line. So, when they're getting the PR benefit by saying that everything is environmentally friendlier and things like that, but they're also, what they're actually saying is that we are getting more efficient in our supply chain and our materials usage and all that stuff.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, I buy this. The other thing I wanted to point out is that, you know, Brian, you said that you see the merging of the two form factors. Keep in mind that if now that the iPad Pro has an M1 chip,
yeah,
there's very little keeping,
yes,
Big Sur for being ported to the iPad Pro.
Yes.
So there is a path now to a touchscreen.
Well, right, exactly. There's a path now, right. I'm not going to do something dumb like make predictions and things like that. But yeah, we're 3 years away from, we will have touchscreen Macs, but they'll do it in that way that I described, where it's like, it'll be the iMac that pulls down when you need to draw on it, and it'll be, you know, I don't know how they'll do it. Actually, that'll be interesting to watch. Is like, you know, they already have essentially a laptop where, you know, you've got these keyboards and hinges and things like that, and we've already got mouse and all that stuff in the iPad stuff. So right, it's just what will they do the first time that they're like, will they call it a MacBook Pad or something like a Pad Pro Mac or something like eventually it's just going to meld together probably in the portable space first.
It feels like, you know, like, so the problem that I have with a lot of these conversations is that we're old and part of it is like, we remember a lot of these variations and generations.
You're right.
And it's sometimes helpful, you know, to sort of, you know, format the SD card and basically like start all over. And so, you know, Brian, like, if you were explaining to your kids these different devices in this like 3 to 5 year time frame for you, would you really bother to take them through the tour of, you know, Finder and like all these other things, or would they just sort of be living in like a networked operating system world where they have their Apple ID, they authenticate to different devices through, you know, touch, through face, through augmented reality, through Apple glasses, which they're wearing all the time, you know, acquired Aura or something, and that's like the constant, you know, biometric authentication tool or something. And the thing that you're talking about, where there's this merger of the Mac desktop and the portable iPad, to me feels like, one, it's almost like a fait accompli in terms of the user interface in many respects. Like, yes, there's a keyboard sort of element, and that's for typing, and there's like a mouse element, and that's for, you know, not putting your grubby fingers on the screen. But ultimately, Apple is merging these two computing paradigms. One is touch and direct manipulation, and the other is indirect and typing. And that eventually is going to go away when voice actually becomes useful.
They're already jumping. The puck is already on the other side of the ice, and they're talking about like, just, you're going to use your AirPods or your AR glasses, your eyeglasses or whatever they're going to be. You're right. Go on. Sorry.
Yeah. No. So I mean, I think on the one hand, like, I'm vehemently like agreeing with you, but I'm coming from the future and sort of coming back to you and saying, why are you still talking about this? Like, you know what I mean? Like, all the things that, and maybe this is just to acknowledge like your point, which is that the M1 being the chip of sort of, not notability, but, you know, the one that's
unification,
being used all these
unification,
right? Which is the plan all along. We've talked about graphics independence for a long time. All those things are merging together, which hopefully will allow a new type of just, you know, application of computing in many, many more lived experiences. And that, I think, is going to be the major shift. And the question is, once we start bringing in, computing into more contexts that are more casual, where previously it would have been really annoying or irritating to think about getting out your phone and kind of like doing a search for something and not quite sure what you're going to get, to one where you do have these assistants that live with you and you just talk to them and you tell them what you want. And, you know, through the magic of the internet, these things just kind of appear to you because you have a subscription to like the best possible content. That's a very different world that we'd be living in. So I think it's important, again, maybe go back to first principles of the experience that most consumers will have when they're interacting with a computer, because they're not thinking about it as a computer.
Right. I just want to say, I buy Wesley's point that the thinness ultimately comes down to efficiencies, more than I buy the thinness comes down to the fact that this is all being unified. In 5 years, we're going to have an iMac that detaches and you can carry around. Like, right. I think David raised it originally, right? Like, if Apple wanted to, they could make it thicker and have more functionality, right? Yeah. And charge,
well, they have,
you know,
higher,
less.
Higher end, right? And they have a visual design specifically for those types of products. They're saying, you know, if you really want to go in that high end, you know, we've got those products for you. But for everyone else, you're going to get like this very svelte sort of thin, you know, visual design. And aren't you going to be impressed that we packed in even more computing power into a thinner design?
I don't know, because the argument that this is for the average Joe and not us, the average Joe is not going to notice if it's half a millimeter thicker, right? I agree that it's way more efficient, you know, if Apple can get the materials down.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. I don't know that, you know, normal, you know, users are necessarily going to like notice the millimeter, but they're going to talk about it, and they're going to notice when they go to their friend's house and they've got, you know, the new shiny, colorful, you know, Mac in, you know, or the iPhone in purple relative to, you know, a PC or a Chromebook.
Well, right? They'll notice that the color. I don't know if they'll go and stand beside it and be like, "Wow, look how thin."
especially because it's not like it's not being lifted up, right? Like, to David's original point, it's not being picked up or anything. Like, it's just standing there.
Yeah, but I mean,
I'm with Chris on this. Go on.
Yeah, like imagine walking into a friend's house. Like, so what is this computer replacing? And if it's replacing a PC for starters, right? And I haven't had a PC or probably seen one in years at this point. But like, you know, you go to like someone's house who you've always known has had a PC, let's say for like the last 5 years. And finally, they're ready to replace it, and they replace it, and then you come over. I mean, they're going to be like, bring this thing out, like, you know, it's the family jewels. So it feels like the relationship to it in that capacity is what's different, and the delta between what was there before, not for people who replace their computers every year, you know, and you know have that privilege. It's for a lot of folks who have, let's say, had an iMac that's like this huge honking thing for a couple of years. And now they're replacing it with the latest thing. And that's where they're going to see the most difference.
Yeah, no, so I completely agree with you that the delta between whatever they had before to the new iMac is going to be much more valuable. I'm talking about the delta between Apple making it, you know, however much thinner or thicker.
Yep.
I think that delta is much better addressed by Wesley's point of like, it's about how much cheaper it is to ship it because of weight and driving down efficiencies. All that makes a lot more sense to me than, you know, that someone's going to, like, we will notice that it's that much thinner than it could have been. I don't think the average person, they're going to notice the color and they're going to notice, oh, that's new and shiny, but they're not going to go and like, wow, it's, you know, that many millimeters thinner than it could have been.
Yeah. I take your point. Okay. So we've been wrapping on hardware for, almost an hour now. When I blew up the space, and by the way, I did pin the tweet about, the Echo Show, if you guys want to check that out. To pivot to something that was actually early in the Apple event film, and something that Brian, I know, has a deep relationship to, and I don't even know if he's had the chance to dig into this yet, but this is something that he and I have been talking a lot about lately, and of course that is the change to the podcast app, which I feel like has been like this sleeping giant that, you know, Apple for so long was like, whatever, it's cool, you know, we don't really think there's much of a market there, people are not going to pay for podcasts, so we'll just let them, you know, it was sort of a benefit to the iPod, you know, back in the day, hence the name podcast. It was a way for people to get access to essentially, you know, radio and talk content on a device that was designed for music. And so it was sort of come also kind of content experience that, of course, over the years, and especially over the last year, maybe the last 2 to 3 years, that content space has exploded. And, you know, to me, there are several big things that have happened in the space. You know, there's social audio, obviously, which we're experiencing now. And then there's also the move to premium and exclusive content, which is all about what Scott Galloway calls the rundle, the recurring revenue bundle. In other words, let me give you a bunch of, you know, pieces of content that you just can't say no to because, you know, it's, yeah, like Netflix, you know, accessing millions of billions of pieces of content for $17, $19 a month, whatever it is. And Apple is trying to do the same thing. And so podcasts have been the one space where you really can't spend money on podcasts. You can go to Patreon, you know, and sort of do a side load kind of like, hey, here's a tip for what you're doing. I really appreciate it. But for the most part, podcasts are monetized through advertising. And so this move to premium subscription-based podcast content, I think is really going to shake things up. We just heard an announcement from Facebook wanting to get into the space. Spotify obviously has exclusive that are coming. They've just blogged about how they want to break their connection to RSS. So this seems all predicated and designed to preempt Apple's announcement today. So the tea leaves were out there for anyone who's close enough and connected enough to read them. And now they're out there for us to see and to interpret. So Brian, your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm going to come in hot here.
Please do.
I'm going to a big AI startup demo day here in the city tomorrow, and I will 100% be decked out in Mack Weldon clothing. Why? Well, Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes, but feel like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Breathable underwear that keeps you cool, dry, and comfy all day. That's their AirKnit underwear. Crazy, comfortable, but elevated sweatpants, the Ace Collection. An upgraded classic polo with antimicrobial silver threads, the Silver Peak Polo. That's my personal fave. And ultra-soft antimicrobial tees for when you need to stay fresh longer. Their silver crewneck t-shirt.
Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code RIDE. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code RIDE.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
So this is a huge swing and a miss by Apple from everything that I've seen so far.
Wow.
For sure, I believe it's been confirmed that Apple's going to take their traditional 30% cut of revenue generated through podcast subscriptions, which would drop to their 15% after a year. But they're like, you know, pricing, you can do 50 cents a month or you can do whatever you want, but
you also have to pay $20 to get into the program, the Apple developer program.
The developer program, exactly. So I can give you the straight up economics, and I'm going to tiptoe around this a bit. Okay. Because, you know, I have deals with a couple different people.
Because reasons.
But the industry standard take is 10%, right? So it's similar to what Substack does. So, you know, we have subscription programs and for the Tech Meme Ride Home. We use two different vendors to do it. It's 10% industry standard. Then you've got the Stripe fees on top of that. So essentially, you know, I'll just say it. Like, I charge $5 a month for our subscription product. I see about $420. Ha ha ha. That's literally true. About $420.
And also today.
Uh-huh. Yes, exactly. So I know what I'm saying. But
you mean $4.20
exactly.
Of the $5.
Yes, okay. Out of the $5. So,
and 80 cents is going to whom?
Around 10% is right. No. So around 10% is going to the partner that does the subscription stuff. Then the remaining percentage there, the whatever pennies is going to Stripe and the
is that Supercast? You work with Supercast?
Supercast and Glow, which just got bought by Libsyn.
I'm curious.
Now I do know that Patreon charges less. Like, I keep hearing this 5% rate and 8% rate and things like that. I don't know about that. Now, I do know, listen, by the way, this is not a small business. Like, people are acting like this is a, like, I know podcasters that are making six figures a month, and not a few.
Wow.
Through Patreon, okay? And through their subscription programs, through people like Glow, and there's not a few, there are a lot. And so essentially, this is a very good business to be in, because you can have, if you have a successful podcast, you can have a public-facing, ad-supported podcast that is hopefully getting, you know, six figures in downloads per episode, and then you're making a lot of money with that.
I mean, there wouldn't be, you know, billions of podcasts, you know, in terms of the explosion,
right,
if people weren't making money and there wasn't a goal.
Well, I mean, and also look at certain podcasters' Patreon pages. If someone's saying they're getting 35,000 patrons a month and they're charging $5 a month, do the math. Like, it's not that hard to see what people are doing. All right, so number one, coming back to Apple.
Yeah.
That 30% is a non-starter, because it doesn't take into account any reality for the creators. And so that's the number one thing, is that, like, it's sort of been painted as this is Apple's acknowledgement of, you know, we want to be a part of this creator economy. We want to support creators. Well, in this space, they have no idea what creators are doing. So the second part of it is that, like, and Ashley was here and she had to go and she's written about this. So I'm going to quote specifically from her tweets and her piece. If you're going to be a platform and a tool for creators, one of the things that you have to do, aside from, in theory, not charging them a 30% fee, you know, being reasonable about it, is you want to give them analytics and data. Well, that's not Apple's game. So Ashley's tweet from 5 hours ago says that she confirmed.
I pinned it to the space.
Yeah, podcasters will receive no specific info about their subscribers, like emails, which, listen, I don't collect people's emails. I don't need that. But the apart from whatever analytics Apple provides, like where your show is most popular. So, okay. If you're Apple and you're like, I don't want to sell people's data or whatever, but if you are a creator and a sole proprietor and you're this, then suddenly knowing emails and things like that, like you want to own that. That is kind of part, that's your business, right?
Keep going.
Okay. So I understand the privacy angle. I understand that. But if the idea of being a creator and creating a creator business is that you have this audience that is with you, then you have to be able to have a closer relationship to that audience. And so, again, this is all, you know, hours old.
I
could take the devil's advocate side of this.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, so I think this is great news. It's just another option. Unlike the App Store and iOS, where the only option is the App Store, as far as I know, you can still sideload your paid subscriptions.
You can still take an RSS feed. In fact, I think that's what, if I read it correctly, that you can still do. So essentially you can mint maybe subscriber content and then just offer an RSS feed that can be taken off to some other platform.
Right, exactly. And it's not exclusive, right? They don't say you can only have your subscribe, you know, version of your podcast on us.
That I don't know. There might be content that you have to make exclusive to your Apple feed in order to get the upside or to participate in that
again,
marketplace.
Quoting Ashley, confirm that Apple Podcast subscription content has to be uploaded through Apple's backend, not through RSS. The regular content that you've had in the feed can still go through RSS, but if you do the subscription stuff, it has to go through them. It's not an open RSS feed.
Yeah.
Right.
So you can just syndicate it everywhere.
You could still have your paid version of Patreon or whatever if you wanted to alongside the Apple version, right?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, no, as far as I know, they haven't said you can only do it through us. I'm sorry. I wasn't listening close enough.
Okay. No, that's a good detail. I didn't know about, you know, having to update it through there and there's no RSS. I guess that makes sense. But yeah, I mean, like I said before, I think this is great. It's another option. You can make your audience broader, that they have a credit card with Apple. They don't want to go to Patreon. They weren't going to do that anyways, perhaps. And they can pay you this way. You get a little less. You don't get emails, certainly. But, you know, there's just some people that maybe they want a third party in between. I guess Patreon's a third party, but you know, maybe they trust Apple more to cancel subscriptions and everything else. So I see it as a win, especially in the fight against Spotify and removing RSS and making this last great open area of the internet as Spotify tries to close that down and remove RSS and everything else. I think this is good that it's that we have sideloading. Like if they removed sideloading, this would be a very sad day, but I love that we still have this option and Apple's still, I guess for now, maybe it's like, I don't know who's bigger, but it's teetering on Spotify or Apple. But I think this is good news, I think, to take the other side of the argument.
Yeah, I think the there's another point with the Apple's like in-app purchase. There is no... Hi there.
Yep. Keep going.
There is no purchase. There is no like alternative arrangement for in-app purchase. It's Apple's way or the highway, right? And so Apple hasn't locked down the, you know, the supercasts of the world or the Patreons. So in this sense, they actually have to compete to earn those subscriptions.
That's
because they're not willing to, you know, take that PR hit of like, oh, we've shut down all feeds that aren't actually listed for free in the directory. So, you know, what are they offering for that 30%, right? They're like, oh, billing management, customer support. All the sort of stuff that they've, you know, had built out since before they were selling apps in the first place.
That's an interesting point because I've never used Patreon, so I'm not shilling for them or anything. But the thing that podcasters have been doing on Patreon is amazing. Like if you go to any Patreon page, like, you know, the things that you can do where it's like subscriber only posts and like you can add Discord channels to it, you can do polls and things like that. Like one of my favorite podcasts, Blank Check, like they did a March Madness this year that went on for a full month, like deciding what the next movies were that they were going to do the podcast about. And like that's all done through the Patreon. So I'm again, okay, for the 30%, I hear what you're saying, that Apple has, you know, all this platform that's set up, but it remains to be seen. I don't know that Apple has proven to anyone that they're good at social stuff and, like, providing a platform for creators or anything like that. So, I mean, look, it's less than 12 hours since this has been announced, so it remains to be seen. But again, I'm super, super, super skeptical at this point, but...
Yeah.
I guess my pushback on this, and again, I'm not trying to be an Apple fanboy. I'm just trying to like understand this strategy in the broader ecosystem as it's evolving. There's been a sort of a thread around splinternets occurring, you know, in the next, you know, several years or decades, largely based on geographic boundaries and restrictions. But it seems like in some ways that splinternet is actually coming as a sort of splintered content net, in that once you introduce payments and exclusivity or the ability to charge for content, now you have to protect that content and make sure that it doesn't, you know, sort of get syndicated in places or to audiences that, let's say, haven't paid for it or are not paying customers. And it feels like where Apple is going, especially with the Apple One subscription, and I think if you look at what Apple is doing in gaming with their Apple Arcade, like this feels like they're essentially doing a couple things. One, and I don't know this, you know, I don't have any inside information, but I can imagine that there are people who have large audiences of podcast subscribers, and they're looking at Spotify and they're looking at other places in the market, and they're saying, hey, why are we not getting paid for the content that you're distributing through the podcast app? And Apple was like, okay, we'll respond and we'll basically take the exact same terms and model that we have for iTunes and for music and apply it to podcasts. And that's the deal. And from there, they can evolve it. But it's harder to sort of start from 15% and go upwards in terms of the take rate versus going downwards. So it seems like they're starting there at what is already working and where they have these deals already arranged. One thing that is important about this that is probably hard for us to understand, and I don't fully understand it, but Apple announced that they are rolling this out to, or at least it'll be made available in 170 countries. And that is, I believe, more than double than what Spotify is offering. So if you want your content to get a global audience and you want to be able to charge people all around the world for it, Apple will take care of that. So the 30% cut that they take is about actually possibly giving you access to a much larger pie than Spotify.
How is Apple doing distribution for you? They're not. That's not what this is.
What do you mean? Just explain.
No, because all they're saying is that if you want to do a subscription to your podcast, a subscription fee, we'll help you do that. They're not saying that we're going to help your podcast grow an audience or anything. Like we're going to give you a larger platform.
That's not true.
Okay.
From what I'm reading, like so a couple things, and I'll take your point, but they're introducing some new things, one of which they call channels. And it sounds like channels is part of their discovery engine. So if you are in, let's say I take your point that if every individual podcast wants to charge their own rate, then it isn't like an Apple One subscription where essentially you're inside and you're paying, you know, $30 a month or whatever it is, and you get access to a bunch of, you know, exclusive content. That's kind of where my mind was going. You're right. If this becomes the next form of, you know, audio substacks and I have to pay $5 for each podcast that I'm listening to, that becomes pretty onerous pretty quickly. What I did read though in what Apple's offering is they use the term they will protect your content. Now, I don't know what that means, but that is somewhat interesting relative to, again, you know, the fact that you could just take an RSS feed and plug it into some other reader, and now you've distributed that paid content elsewhere.
Yeah, reading through the agreement, all of the exclusive content in Apple Podcasts will be DRM protected with their AirPlay stuff.
Got it. Yeah. So AirPlay is also a big important part of that too. Nathan, do you want to say anything about your background?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a sort of an indie designer developer who built a tool called pod.link, which was just a free landing page to help podcasters link to their show across the entire ecosystem of podcasts and all the top podcast apps. So, you know, one like link in bio type solutions so that you don't have to just link somebody to Apple Podcasts. You can also link to your Spotify and your Overcast and all the way down the line.
This is actually how Nathan and I got in touch. I was using PodLink basically because I liked the ability to link to essentially, I don't, you know, this is actually sort of a problem that I have with my partner. Like I would send her links to podcasts. And at the time I was listening to podcasts through Google Podcasts, which she didn't use. And so I was like, I don't really know what she uses. So I want to send her a link that's going to work. And so PodLink was kind of like the intermediary. And through that, Nathan and I actually sort of connected. And then I think you built an Alfred workflow, or I asked you to build one. And anyways, I won't go too far down that path. But just to say that Nathan's coming at this, and I don't mean to speak on your behalf, but I will, in the sense that he's able to link to all these different providers and all these different podcast players, all these podcatchers, if you will. And so this creates a very interesting, you know, wiggle in this business. If suddenly there are a bunch of protected content that's out there, maybe there will be, you know, profiles or landing pages for these protected pieces, but you have to pay in order to access the content. You know, that's a pattern that we're seeing more and more, especially in the video landscape and in TV shows and things like that. And so it just makes it a lot harder and starts to break down, you know, what is the free and open web when you start landing at a bunch of, you know, paywalled content.
Yeah, if the platforms all want a cut of, you know, some subscription revenue, you're offering it through Apple and through Spotify and through, you know, three other apps, you know, they're still going to want to promote it as if it's one thing. And so that's the challenge for, you know, anybody who's building tools for podcast creators. They're not going to be able to rely on, oh, well, it's just one single RSS feed. And I have ways to look that up in each of the various platforms. Now I got to, right, you know, maybe do a little bit more hard work. There's not open APIs to fetch all of this data easily.
I guess like the point when I come back to like the creator economy, that seems really, really tricky, which is that, I mean, let me start from just brass tacks. As it is, as a creator, if I want to publish content to each different platform, just to like keep all my, you know, followers up to date, that in and of itself, you know, is its own full-time job. If then I need to also remember.
Are you saying that in a podcasting context?
No, I'm saying it as an internet content creator that decides to publish on, you know, Medium, Instagram, you know, Twitter, Facebook, yada, yada, right? Like that has become a very large amount of work just to cross syndicate your content on all these different platforms and to cut it up into reels, into stories, into who knows, right? Now what I'm suggesting is adding to that matrix a whole nother level of complexity when it comes to pricing your content, remembering what is premium, what is not, you know, basically being able to feed the beast of free ad-supported content as well as premium content that is exclusive. Or maybe it's freemium content, which is, you know, a teaser and sort of gets you into a higher grade or higher paid tier.
Yeah, so, Apple also lets you monetize your back catalog. So you could say like, hey, day and date, it's free. But, you know, if you want something older than 3 weeks, you got to pay. And alternatively, you can, you know, flip it on its head. Hey, paid subscribers get early access. You know, it's going to go out in the RSS feed, you know, 5 days from now, 2 days from now.
Right, right. So more exclusive or timeliness or whatever. Yeah, so I don't know. It seems to me that these are broad swaths where a bunch of companies are moving in this direction. And that's the new kind of battlefronts that are being drawn. And for so long, Apple has been a fairly neutral player in the podcast space. And as of today, that is no longer the case.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
That is, and I'm only going to speak narrowly about the podcast space again. And I hope you guys aren't thinking that I'm like being too pedantic about it because this is my space.
I mean, it is your space, so yeah.
But what I will say is this: is that as podcasters, that most of the people that I know that are doing subscription stuff, they're on Patreon. They're paying at most 12%, so the 30% is a non-starter. It would be interesting if there was going to be some sort of like Jesus Christ, there's a giant truck going by outside. If there was some sort of like algorithmic uptake, like that's the shoe that we've always been waiting to drop in terms of like the Spotify stuff. And it, at least as far as I know, unless you've been bought by Spotify, it hasn't happened yet. Like the partners that they have, like Pushkin, who has like, you know, the Malcolm Gladwell podcast and the Michael Lewis podcast and things like that, and NPR or whatever, those are the sort of partners that you would expect them to have in. If I am podcasts that I know that are making six figures with Patreon, there's no reason to go to Apple to do this, to give away double your take to somebody else. There's nothing that I'm seeing, and I've been trying to read as we've been talking all this stuff, that there's any sort of algorithmic uptake on this. So like, this is actually a good thing. Like, one of the things that I'm always fearful of, if I wake up and I find out that Apple is too involved in the space, every day that I wake up and RSS isn't broken is a great day. And so even though they're doing this and they're for the first time getting into the space and trying to monetize it, they're doing it with one hand tied behind their back, and they're only doing it on this sort of subscription sort of stuff. So it's like, basically, you can ignore this. You can join them if they want to write you a check or whatever, or you can keep doing Patreon. So like, this is what I'm saying, where I feel like this is a nothing if you're a podcaster, because there's nothing that they have proposed here that would make people leave Patreon. There's nothing that would be like, oh, I've never thought of doing a subscription thing. If people want to do it, great. Apple has the platform for it. But there's nothing that is in any of these announcements that is like, oh, I would really consider this because all of a sudden I think they can double my audience or something like that.
I just like, okay, I will accept your point. Like it is a good and fair point. And I guess I go back to the way in which Apple launches and rolls out products, which is that if you think about the very first App Store, you know, and what it offered, it was very, very primitive and very, very basic. Apple has a real tendency of, you know, coming out with something that's just the bare minimum and then growing up and building up from there. Now, I'm not saying that they will, but if you look at the amount of energy and movement around content around Apple TV and Apple TV Plus, and then you look at like the App Store, and podcasts have been kind of like, I mean, ironically, they've actually have this enormous back catalog of content that's just been freely distributed for years and years and years.
And yes, Apple but people have been, saying, this is where I'm saying people have been monetizing this. You just are not aware of it. Like
what I'm saying. Like, and people were monetizing apps before the App Store.
Yes, yes.
Okay. What I'm saying is, if you play this out over the next 10 years, what does this look like as far as a piece of important type of content that is, you know, it provides value for AirPods, it provides value for being in the Apple entertainment ecosystem, so that when you subscribe to become an Apple customer for life, at some point this content may be available to you as well. And that may drive more revenue for people over the longer term, over the long horizon. Like, to me, this is a bit of a squeeze on Spotify.
Oh, no. And in fact, that's what I was going to say. But and then I'm going to get off my high horse.
Okay.
The best thing about this is that I would prefer Apple to have woken up a little bit as opposed to just letting Spotify roll the space.
Yeah.
I would much rather, if I had to choose between a Spotify or an Apple taking over podcasting, I hope neither of them ever succeed in doing that. I'd rather it be Apple. So, but I'm glad that Apple is not just continuing to sleep on the space. So if you're right, if this is just a first stirring, then that's great, because I am not impressed with Spotify at all and some of the moves that they're making.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think you can view this as not as an either or with Patreon for the time being. I think a lot of podcasters just, you know, set up a subscription show on Apple Podcasts to get the free real estate that
they're not
never had
asking
the advantage
for exclusivity. It's not like a Joe Rogan or a Ringer situation. Like, you can do whatever you want. It's just another option. They're not asking for
And you can price it to take into account Apple's 30% cut, so that walk away with the same thing, and just hope that the Apple audience is not as price sensitive. But I think where the launch partner that is the most curious to me is The Athletic.
Yeah.
Because they offer, mm-hmm. like, their bundle is all of this writing on The Athletic website. And this whole time they've said, like, and we kind of have podcasts too. You got to listen to them inside our own app where it's not really the best podcasting experience. And they eventually, like, slightly opened that up a little bit. But here they are, like, joining, you know, as a full-fledged, like, you know, competitor, like, right there next to Luminary as, like, oh, no, podcasting's as if that's our whole thing.
That's a good point. Yeah, I was going to bring up, like, mm-hmm. how does this fit into the News Plus audio stuff? Or is that interesting?
Yeah, are these totally separate subscriptions?
Right.
Like, you're subscribing to The Athletic podcast network as a separate fee from your news thing. You most likely cannot connect your accounts in any way. I haven't heard any, like, whispers around, you know, something like that. It's not like they can comp every single, you know, person who already is paying on the website, and then Apple doesn't get a cut at all.
This is such a good point, just in terms of, you know, one, tying subscriptions to the Apple ID into the Apple user. And of course, sign in with Apple is a big part of their strategy, especially in Safari and on the web. And so as that increasingly rolls out, then you can imagine that there might be, you know, satellite websites that you can go to access exclusive content that is driven through Apple Pay. And so that's an important part of this as well. And then this other point where we move away from the concept of podcasts as being this special, you know, kind of syndicated format to one where it's just asynchronous audio consumption, that when you maybe subscribe, you know, to The Athletic in the podcast app, and then you hop over into Apple News, suddenly you're getting access to exclusive content that's part of your subscription that's folded into Apple's other properties. And so, Brian, in some ways, that actually answers your question about algorithmic amplification.
Yes.
Because if, let's say, I have a premium subscription to the Tech Meme Ryan Home podcast, and I go into the Apple News app, and I'm browsing around and seeing a story, and then there's a podcast that's listed as related, well, that gets to be pretty interesting.
Well, and also,
benefit to me.
The most interesting thing to me would be if the next step is bundling, like people are starting to do on Substack, right? Like, yeah. if Apple suddenly said, well, there's one subscription and you can join it and you'll get a cut depending on how many downloads you get, like a Spotify sort of esque model.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, yeah. Right.
Which I've been waiting for Spotify to do. Let me just do one more thing here, and then again, I really hope people don't think I'm hogging this. This is something that I have to also tread lightly on.
I got it.
Various people have various ideas about what is a loss leader. And I'm thinking of people, or not a loss leader, but a customer acquisition vehicle. Yep. And people like The Athletic and people like Substack have different ideas of what that is. And I would say, The Athletic thinks of podcasts as customer acquisition, and maybe they're changing their strategy so that they're monetizing that, versus other people like Vox think of it in reverse. Like, there are certain media entities that podcasts are their bread and butter.
Like The Economist is a really good example of this. They put out a bunch of really, really great podcasts, and it's to drive the print subscription, which I find sort of backwards
and ironic. So what I'm trying to say, treading lightly, is in this world of athletics and subsects and things like that, and there's, you know, there's multiple SKUs, a multi-SKU business and things like that.
Right.
Various people have different ideas of where podcasting, because everyone just wants that ARR. It just depends on what they think the most valuable part of that
asset
ARR
that they
is.
Produce.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I was curious, Brian, you said that you'd rather, like, Apple would be the lesser of two evils versus Spotify to take over podcasting. I'm curious why, because I would prefer a world where, you know, Spotify has all of audio and the big tech companies continue to have all their fingers in all their pies.
Because you can sideload RSS into Apple Podcast and you can't sideload RSS into Spotify.
Well, that's now, just like they're not doing exclusives now, but I would say.
Like, okay, as carefully as I can tread, I think from my perspective, when I look at Spotify, their goal is still to increase their margins vis-a-vis what they have to pay to record companies. And so that podcasting is basically wide open and free versus like these contracts where down to the penny you have to pay for stream and things like that. So I am not impressed by what Spotify is doing in the space yet, because I don't know how much they value audience building. I think that this is just their get out of jail free card in terms of margins and being, you know, married to the record companies for their entire business.
I think you and I are a little bit different on that just because of the experience. I don't know.
Yeah. But then look, listen, and you know what, we need to wrap up. So we don't have to go into this now, but, the fact that if you download my podcast from Spotify, you're not downloading it from an RSS feed. Like they take from my RSS feed and then they feed it to you something else. Like I'm an old man. I believe in the open standards and the open web. I don't want RSS to be killed. I don't want it to be Spotify is just the new person that takes an open part of the web and throws a fence around it, like has happened to, you know, everything from blogging to whatever.
Right. I think that makes sense.
Yeah, Wesley, you want to chime in here?
Yeah, I've been saving up my points, so please bear with me.
Go for it.
Just to tail off what you said, Brian, about RSS and you don't want it to die, I wanted to highlight that this new subscription model is not RSS, which means they are not bound by the restrictions of RSS. Mm-hmm. So we're not just talking about video, we're not just talking audio, but this opens the door for interactive content.
Yeah.
If you've ever seen the book, my kid had this. It's like there's a monster at the end of this book,
right? Yeah.
Think about that possibility with subscription models or something like that. And have you heard of ASO? It's kind of like SEO, but for App Store optimization.
Yes,
That is going to be a huge driver. Like right now, there's a lot of podcasts that say give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, and
yep. Right.
You turn on the subscription and you get high marks. I bet that's going to help with the ASO for a lot of people. So that's a big, big incentive for people to adopt this. And my last point, just throwing this in here.
Yeah.
Don't be surprised if there's like a malformed RSS feed that crashes or causes a security risk to Apple Podcasts and they have to turn off that feature to sideload RSS feeds for security reasons.
Yeah.
Interesting. You don't think that after all this time they would have like sanitized like all that RSS stuff?
It'll be an excuse, though. I think is what you're saying.
I see. Maybe.
Is there something that's interesting, like with Spotify and podcasts, where it's a pay per podcast model versus when I first saw the headline, I was expecting it to be like a bundle sort of setup.
With Spotify or? What do you mean?
Yeah, with Spotify. Yeah, I was really curious because I was like, okay, yeah, Spotify, I just pay one price and I get all this stuff. Like, no, it's like a per creator, per podcast setup.
Yeah, what I've been seeing in the little hints that I've noticed, as well as other conversations, is just that Spotify does seem to be enabling, you know, exclusive, you know, downloads where you can unlock it, like on an individual basis. It also unlocks podcast interactivity. Specifically, I know that they're exploring polls and Q&A. And to Brian's point, I actually think that Spotify is actually pretty focused on audience development for podcasters. And Brian can tell me that that's, you know, BS because he's not actually seeing any of the results. But I just, you know, feel like Spotify is, I feel like Spotify is closer to working with artists specifically and to building out their fan base and to bring in a lot more different types of data onto artist profiles. And they'll do the same thing for podcasters. Whereas Apple just notoriously, you know, going back to like iTunes ping, just doesn't really seem to do well when it comes to allowing for dynamic content and moving really quickly with trends and with culture. You know, they're much better at producing jewelry than they are at producing, you know, kind of like, you know, lavish events and experiences that people, you know, interact through. So,
well, Spotify has to make this work, right? That they're like not profitable yet or barely profitable.
Yeah.
They have to make this work. Apple, for them, this is a rounding error. Like,
which is a great point. Kind of the point that I was making as well. Chris, we should wrap this up, but we should also make room for anyone that's on stage right now to tell promo whatever
you want. Any last thoughts? Yeah. Anything? Shout outs? Sure. Mm-hmm. any podcasts that you run that are premium subscription.
Wesley, since you were up first, you can go first. You want us to follow you on Twitter? What should we know about you, Wesley?
Yeah, follow me on Twitter, Wesley83. Of course, it's super easy to follow me on Spaces. Just click my profile. But I want to promote my company, Daily, which is we're doing some amazing stuff. We have a couple of launches next week that I'm not going to spoil. But please follow the Daily account at GetDaily. Try Daily. follow Try Daily, and it's going to be pretty earth-shattering, in my opinion. So
wow!
It's going to make some news. So keep your ears there.
All right, I'm gonna go in order. So Emil, you're next, at least on my screen.
Oh, I'm last on my screen. I used to be the executive editor at VentureBeat, and I'm dabbling in newsletters now, so no podcast to plug, but not yet anyway. But one is a monthly one called Phi to Sci, which is about basically what you see in science fiction and how it's happening in our world. So fiction to science, basically, and it's monthly, so it's not that often. And the other one is Big Tech News, which is just what Big Tech has been up to in the week. So that one is weekly, and yep, they're all on my profile. So at ePro. Thank you.
Cool. And all right, we're going by my screen. So Steve, you're next.
Hey, this is Steve Moser. I guess final parting thought on the Apple event is I think the biggest part of the event was the M1 chip and the iPad and having up to 16 gigabytes of RAM and the future possibilities for Pro apps. So I just can't wait to see what they do next with that. But as far as what to plug, follow MacRumors, follow me. Steve Moser. Also, I have a side site called Tape Drive, where I try to go kind of deeper cuts into little Apple changes, but also recently I've gotten into digging into iOS app changes, so trying to find those hidden gems in betas and other app updates.
We should talk.
Definitely.
Also,
Steve makes a good...
Sorry, go ahead.
Steve makes a good point, though. I feel like we didn't talk enough about the iPad and it getting the M1, and what does that actually mean? Because it already was on ARM. So, like, what?
We're terrible hosts, and we get off on our own tangents.
No. That was not meant as a criticism. I just thought it was interesting.
But actually, Steve, 10 seconds. Will we get an M2 chip? Is the next generation chip coming this year?
I think. What is it? Did Apple say it was in 2 years? They would hope to complete the transition. I hope, if it's going to be November, December, something, but M2 chip or M1X, I mean, I'm all off now on, and whatever you think, you know, Apple's naming scheme, they twist it. Right. So I thought it was going to be the A14X. There was even code in there that said A14X. But then they're like, boom, M1 chip. And then, oh yeah, this is M1 chip with the full 16 gigabytes of RAM. So, I think it's a possibility, but the marketing names are really hard to come by in the code, and same thing with those advanced hardware detail. That's all.
Yeah. I wasn't asking you to name the chip. I just want to know when I can update my MacBook Pro to. I don't want to do it on the Gen 1.
Exactly.
All right. So the last person on my screen is Nathan. So Nathan, you're up, and then we can get out of here.
All right. If you have a podcast, check out pod.link. It's a great LinkedIn bio style solution for promoting your own show everywhere. At the beginning of the year, PodLink was acquired by PodSites. So if you're advertising on podcasts and you want to measure that success, check out podsites.com, like Pod Insights smashed together. And then the other thing you should check out is, now that I no longer am working on PodLink in my nights and weekends, my next side project is an API to enable the next generation of podcast platforms. So check out episodes.fm to hear when that's coming next.
That sounds good to me. And it sounds like
some good news.
Both Chris and I will be on that side of it. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, everyone that's listening. This will be put out on the Tech Meme Ride Home this weekend, Saturday afternoon, usually. Thank you, Chris.
Yeah. Thank you, Brian. Thanks, everyone. This is the Tech Meme Ride Home experience following the Apple event on April 20th, 2021. This was a great conversation. I appreciate everyone for being here, and we will do these again sometime soon in the future. Thanks.
Thank you all.